This is 91.3, your NPR station since 1985, and this is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, August 16th, 2017. I'm Yitzhak
Grajeda. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead on today's program, a group of Arkansas residents gathered at the office of Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge yesterday to voice concerns over her participation in an effort calling for the phasing out of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, or DACA. She's one of 10 attorneys general to sign a letter sent to the United States Attorney General to end the program. That report in about 8 minutes.
But first, race and immigration are two issues that have come to the fore under the current administration. The 287G program is of particular interest to many living in Northwest Arkansas. This U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement initiative allows a state or local law enforcement group to enter into a partnership with ICE to receive authority for immigration enforcement within their jurisdictions. ICE currently has agreements with 60 law enforcement agencies in 18 states. The only two participating in Arkansas are the Benton and Washington County Sheriff's Offices. Yesterday, the Washington County Sheriff's Office was the location of the annual 287G Steering Committee meeting. Following a slideshow presentation, the meeting was open to public comment. About 50 people attended, and of those who spoke, every one of them spoke against the program.
There's deep concern in our community from your voters and your constituents that this program does not work for us.
I honor every one of you and what you are trying to do. But I also feel that you are supporting a system, supporting a program that is deeply, deeply flawed.
The kids should not come to school being scared and being afraid that their parent might be taken away.
That was Gladys Tiffany, Edwin Williams, and Denise Nelson. In addition to expressing displeasure with the program, some constituents asked questions. When asked if having a diverse population is the reason the program exists in Benton and Washington counties, 287G program manager James Bogger said demographics have absolutely nothing to do with whether or not someone is accepted into the program.
Certainly, if someone were to say they want the program due to a racial nature, we would most likely, I would say definitely, reject that program.
A discussion arose as to why ICE needed local officials to do their job. Bogger said they will take all the help they can get.
We don't have the ability to be everywhere 24 hours a day, so we welcome the assistance.
What would you be doing if they weren't doing it?
Most likely we would be going into the community, knocking on doors, going to businesses. We think it's a better use of resources to try to encounter people out of jail, because we're more likely to encounter people who were involved in criminal activity as opposed to going to into the public.
Bogger clarified that an officer can knock on a door without a warrant. However, a warrant would be needed to enter a home. The program does not go into effect until someone is arrested and booked into a detention center. Officials say everyone who is taken into custody at the Washington County Jail, for example, is asked a series of questions, including one about where they were born. Fear as a result of this program is one issue that was brought up repeatedly. Audience members argued undocumented immigrants are afraid to call the authorities in an emergency or if they've been a victim of a crime for fear of being deported. One man gave an example of a couple who's been living in the U.S. for nearly two decades. Bogger said his friends may have options regarding their immigration status.
This program is not something that they should be afraid of. Obviously, if they're not breaking the criminal laws, they won't end up here, so they'll never encounter the 287G program. But if they did, again, the ironic part of it is they would actually be eligible for defensive adjustment of status that they would not be otherwise eligible for. So they would most likely, if those folks came through the doors here, they would eventually end up most likely getting a green card because they have U.S. citizen children and they've been here for over 10 years, which, barring any other circumstances, would make them eligible for defensive cancellation of removal that they would only be eligible for if placed into removal proceedings by ICE.
Thomas Byrd, an ICE public affairs officer, said for people who are victims or witnesses of a crime, there are processes by which they can receive visas.
There's the T visa and the U visa. So when I hear people say that they're afraid to report a crime or they're afraid to call if they're a victim of a crime, we need to get that information out to people so that they understand that there are processes in place, legal visas that they can get that will keep them here because of that.
Local resident Lauren Husband said there seems to be a communication breakdown between law enforcement officers and the public.
You can obviously see a lot of members view this program as negative, whereas you guys view it as helpful to society. So I was wondering how you are planning on, how do you guys communicate the positive impacts of this program to people?
287G program manager James Bogger said people can learn more by visiting a local U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services office or by visiting the organization's website. That's uscis.gov. Washington County Sheriff Tim Helder said this meeting, which included a presentation on the program and solicited community feedback, was a form of communication.
What is this meeting about if it's nothing more than you all telling us what you want, but are you listening to some of these avenues? You have the ability to talk to people. Frank, for sure. I mean, listen, you asked. That's one way. Can this be done better? Certainly. Communication can always be better. I will tell you, in the 10 years we've been involved in this program, this is the first time anybody from the community has been here. I think we can attribute that to a change in administration, right? Am I right?
Absolutely.
Otherwise, why weren't you here before?
So we did not know this meeting happened.
We advertised, Gladys. I mean, all I can tell you is that people are up in arms more now because of the current administration. You can say what you want, but that's why you're here.
Helder said when he took over as sheriff in 2005, immigration was a hot-button issue and there was pressure to get involved. As a participant in the 287G program, Helder said he's trying to find balance.
If I were today to say no more, we're not involved in this immigration thing, we're going to turn a blind eye to people that are living here illegally and committing criminal acts, I would fill Bud Walton with people that are just as passionate as you are. I mean, like it or not, I'm just making a statement, okay? I'm just making a statement. Now let me finish, let me go on. Because of that sentiment, what I felt we did was find balance in that we, even though we don't direct policy, if it was determined by ICE, the 287G program, that we would go out and target, do workplace enforcement, we would back out. And that was my commitment from day one.
Helder said the partnership with ICE isn't out of the norm because his department works with several other federal agencies.
I've always felt in law enforcement that was the proper way to conduct our mission, was to share resources. Even though I don't have the ability to direct policies, I have input. I have input at the local level to make determinations if it's still what we need to be doing or if it's wrong. And that's me. It's worked for 38 years, and that's who I am. And you certainly, I think somebody's made mention more than once about you being voters and that you can control outcomes. You certainly have that right to put somebody else in this office to conduct things the way you see exactly fit. I have to balance. I represent 200 and some odd thousand people.
Helder is up for election next year. For more information on the 287G program, you can visit ICE.gov. This is Ozarks at Large.
Injured workers are entitled to workers' compensation, even if they're undocumented immigrants. But an NPR ProPublica investigation found that in Florida, they might get arrested and deported before they get paid.
They're not defrauding the system. They're entitled to the benefits by law.
I'm Audie Cornish, jailed or deported after getting injured at work. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
3 to 6 this afternoon on 91.3.
Supporters of a program that allows undocumented children to stay in the U.S. are urging Arkansas's Attorney General to change her position. Daniel Breen with our partner station KUAR in Little Rock has more.
A large group of supporters and recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program crowded into the Little Rock office of Attorney General Leslie Rutledge. They were there to meet with Carl Vogelpohl, Rutledge's chief of staff, and to present him with a petition organized by the Arkansas United Community Coalition. The group's central organizer is Maria Meneses, a college student and herself a DACA recipient. She says that after trying to meet with Rutledge for a month, she was left unsatisfied by the meeting.
Honestly, I was
was expecting to get answers. I was. Unfortunately, that was not the case. We asked, why is she all of a sudden deciding to take away DACA now? Why did she do that?
Rutledge was one of 10 state attorneys general around the country and one governor who wrote a letter urging U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions to end DACA. Meneses says her group is seeking to meet with Rutledge herself rather than a staff member before a September 5th deadline. That's when states suing the federal government will need to amend an existing lawsuit should the Trump administration choose not to end the program. The group's founding executive director, Maria Reith, says she would rather see the fate of DACA in the hands of Congress rather than President Trump.
We hope that the president once again can let Congress do its job versus taking immediate action that isn't founded on what our electorate and the constituents of our elected officials actually want.
Reith says that Rutledge, who has only met with one DACA recipient previously, should agree to meet with more Dreamers to hear their personal stories.
Our only perception left in absence of a meeting is that she's pandering to political rhetoric versus, again, trying to do something that would be meaningfully helpful.
While meeting with Meneses and the other DACA recipients, Rutledge's chief of staff said he would be happy to listen to their stories, but wouldn't be able to speak on her behalf. In a statement, Rutledge spokesman Judd Deere said the letter she signed with other Republican officials was about upholding the rule of law. Nevertheless, Meneses hopes that Rutledge will have a change of heart before Congress or President Trump is forced to take action.
I hope that she sees that we add value, because on top of that, we want to become doctors, we want to become police officers, law enforcers, and we just want to give back and be contributing members of society. And I hope that she's able to see that and that we're just as American as she is. As well.
In Little Rock, I'm Daniel Breen.
Ahead on today's Ozarks at Large, this summer Pastor Clint Schneckloth traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet with elected officials.
If like Tom Cotton or Steve Womack or John Bozeman are actually listening to this broadcast, you know, what I'd want to say is like what I'm trying to do, it's sometimes hard, is let you know where I'm coming from as a pastor and as a Christian and hope that has some kind of impact on you while still, like, how can I disagree with you while still honoring your office and you as a person.
Our frequent visitor, Pastor Clint Schneckloth, gives us his version of the What I Did This Summer essay ahead on today's show.
On the next Fresh Air, Eric Lipton, a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter who covers corporate agendas and government relations. He's been investigating the extent to which the regulated have become the regulators in the Trump administration. He writes about industry lobbyists who are now in senior positions at many government agencies working to roll back regulations they once fought. Join us.
Fresh Air, twice every weekday at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m., both times right before Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums. The CEO of Walmart says the president has missed an opportunity to bring the country together, but plans to remain on the president's manufacturing council so he can remain engaged in important decisions. Doug McMillon issued his statement yesterday. That was following the initial press conference and press statement the president made this weekend regarding violence and protest in Virginia. But it was before the president held another press conference yesterday afternoon.
The state of Arkansas is partnering with a nonprofit to launch an online job board, rtechjobs.com, in a step to support the emerging industry. Speaking yesterday at the Little Rock Technology Park, Governor Asa Hutchinson hailed it as the newest tool in his push to turn Arkansas into a computer coding and tech hub. He recalled a trip to Silicon Valley early in his term.
When I told them about our computer science initiative and how we're training our young people in coding, their eyes got real big, and all they could think about was bringing all that talent from Arkansas out there to California. And I said, there has got to be a better way.
Hutchinson thinks the job site will both encourage companies to stay or relocate to Arkansas by providing a central hub for talent and encourage job seekers to develop skills and stay in state by conveniently listing employment opportunities. The Arkansas Economic Development Commission will administer the site, which was put together at no cost to the state by the nonprofit R-Code Kids. It's the only state-private partnership on a tech jobs board in the nation. So far, 50 companies ranging from Walmart to Inuvo have signed up to rtechjobs.com to list positions.
Arkansas Senator John Bozeman is recovering from successful heart surgery. A spokesman from his office reports the senator underwent a procedure yesterday recommended by doctors who have been monitoring his aorta since a tear in it was surgically repaired in 2014. Several health clinics in Arkansas will be splitting more than $1.1 million awarded by the Department of Health and Human Services. The Boston Mountain Rural Health Center Incorporated, with 8 locations, including locations in Huntsville, Green Forest, and Deer, will receive more than $75,000, while the River Valley Primary Care Services, with clinics in Fort Smith, Mountainburg, Mulberry, Barling, and Lamar, will receive more than $92,000, and the St. Francis House of Northwest Arkansas will get $40,000. A statement from HHS lists investment in quality service and 2016 achievements by the services among the reasons for the federal financial rewards.
One key critic of Arkansas's juvenile detention system says steps to try and change conditions seem to be an improvement. Governor Hutchinson announced this week he will seek bids from private companies to again run the 8 lockups, which will include some changes. One by the Division of Youth Services calls for more engagement with family members. Sharon Strong, an attorney with the nonprofit group Disability Rights Arkansas, hopes that will lead to less recidivism.
Handling a transition when the kid is released from confinement and then transitions back to his family, there'll be some transition services that are offered. So that's a really important piece that was missing before, and so we do see that as a big positive step.
Strong says she's glad an independent review will be conducted of the system, but worries who will do it. Another concern is a change in education. The state is largely transitioning to the online program Virtual Arkansas for those locked up. But with students coming into the system with broadly different academic abilities, Strong is concerned there won't be enough tailored education that can only come from in-person teachers.
A celebration of the life of Frank Broyles will be held Saturday afternoon at Bud Walton Arena in Fayetteville. The former head football coach and athletic director at the University of Arkansas died this week at age 92. Saturday's celebration will be open to the public. Public and private interests may combine to create a bicycle and skate park near the under-construction U.S. Marshals Museum in Fort Smith. Talk Business and Politics reports the Central Business Improvement District in Fort Smith is considering participation in a $600,000 park. The Marshals Museum is scheduled to open in September 2019. An assistant park superintendent at Mount Magazine State Park is taking over the job as superintendent at another North Arkansas State Park. Bill Lindsay is now the superintendent at Bull Shoal State Park in North Central Arkansas. And the Northwest Arkansas Naturals continue a 3-game series in Midland, Texas tonight after losing to the Rockhounds in 11 innings last night, 4-3.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support for 91.3 comes from Malco Theater's special events featuring Starship Troopers, The Traitor of Mars, Monday, August 21st at 7:30 p.m. at the Razorback Cinema in Fayetteville. Fandango.com for tickets. Additional support provided by Adventure Subaru, featuring fuel-friendly, symmetrical, all-wheel drive vehicles and service in the NELMS tradition. Adventure's eco-friendly dealership, located off Interstate 49 at Porter Road in Fayetteville. AdventureSubaru.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellens. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Pastor Clint Schneckloth from Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville. It's been a while.
It's been a while, but it's great to be back.
We've both had a summer.
Yes.
You've traveled. I got to travel a little bit. Where all did you go?
Well, for our vacation, we went, it was our 20th wedding anniversary. So
ditto.
We went a little big. Yeah, you had the same, didn't you?
Yeah.
So we decided to make it kind of a big thing for our family, and we did a big couple of week trip to Washington, D.C. and New York City. Stayed with some friends who are pastors in those places and just did it big.
Excellent. Smithsonian.
All the Smithsonians. Everybody should go to the African-American Smithsonian if
but
they
get
can.
Your tickets early.
Yes, yeah, so you got to order them in advance, but man. And I did Broadway, saw Aladdin. That was really fun. It was a good trip.
Did you, and you also, of course, worked this summer.
Yeah, I did. Hard.
Did that involve travel?
Yep. So one of the things that I did, this was my second trip. I've made 3 trips to Washington, D.C. this year. Once was for vacation, and the other 2 times so far this year have been to go meet with our elected officials doing some different advocacy stuff. You know, the representatives, when they actually get out in front of a microphone or a TV, they're never going to say, my staffers wrote this bill.
But.
It's their bill
yeah.
that they brought.
It's a team.
but it was a team effort
right.
that got it there. And so if you can meet with the right person, you can actually have a lot of influence.
Do you think it helps, hurts, or is negligible that you can put the word pastor in front of your name?
Well, what we know is that it really matters. Majority of the elected officials in the United States are religious. So they're impacted by moral or religious categories in terms of how they think about public policy. And they recognize authority. You know, they want to be called senator and congressman, and they recognize the whole thing of like titles. And so pastor, doctor, all those kinds of titles matter. And there's just kind of a moral authority that comes along with clergy arriving in any space, really. We show up with our, you know, collars on, and that really does have a certain kind of gravity to it. What we try to do is we try to, you know, like I do this, and I do this regularly. I want our elected officials to hear from their constituents and to be, you know, to have open ears to constituent concerns. And then what my hope is as a pastor is that I can amplify what I'm already hearing from my own parishioners or from the community that I'm a part of and amplify it in a way that also adds that level of like moral gravity. And we find that it does.
Obviously, you're not going to have, it's not an unlimited amount of time that you have either with a staffer or a senator or a congressman.
Mm-mm.
It's in probably no one's best interest if it's an adversarial conversation. So how do you think about, I'll have 20 minutes maybe in this office, mm-hmm. and perhaps you have a suspicion that the elected official I'm going to talk to doesn't share completely my views on a subject. So how do you get there with mm-hmm. a faith-based topic?
So one thing you don't do is you don't bait and switch. So don't go in and say you were meeting with them about immigration and then switch to healthcare, even if that's totally on your mind, because that's not fair to them or their time. And you have to keep in mind, you know, in addition to all the stuff they're actually doing, like say in the House or in the Senate and all that kind of thing, the average senator or congressman is probably investing like half of their time in fundraising. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just chasing stuff all the time. And so if you actually got time with them, they really carved that out for you, you know, and that's kind of impressive. So you want to be respectful that they carved that time out. So what we do, when I went up with LIRS, and then again, this in the middle of the summer, I was there with a really fascinating group. It was an organized visit on international poverty relief, the like global assistance that our country does. And the people that went out for the visits represented a whole bunch of faith-based and charitable organizations. I was representing Oxfam because I do a lot with Oxfam, which Oxfam is not a directly faith-based organization, but they've expanding their connection mm-hmm. to faith-based communities. But it was also like Bread for the World and Feed the Poor and a bunch of other organizations that do this kind of work. And so to do those 20 minutes well, you show up the day before and you do a big kind of orientation with a group. You make sure you know your talking points and you get trained in them so that you've got kind of this like core message that you're bringing. And then the trainers, the people who are gathering you in D.C. to go and meet with the elected officials, they say, you know, basically like, well, here's our main talking points. Please know these, but then also talk from your own experience. So share like what you think as a pastor, why it matters to you personally that the United States remain committed, say, to global poverty assistance. And that matters because then when you go in, they've maybe gotten the mailing from Oxfam or
sure.
whoever that has all the data. What they don't know is why their constituents care or those personal stories. And so you kind of focus in on those. And then you asked about the kind of what if you have different opinions about this? Well, this was where this gets to be really interesting and really fruitful because, for example, this summer we went up, just the basic facts are, the Trump administration proposed back early in the year a budget that had about a 40% total cut in terms of our global commitment to like the international affairs budget. And in real terms, what that would have done is it would have reversed or undermined a whole bunch of initiatives we have that we're funding around the world that reduce things like, communicable diseases, education that is improving the living standards in a whole bunch of places around the world, and feeding programs that are keeping people from going into or at least fending off crisis in terms of like famine. And so that would have had immense human impact if those cuts were to actually become part of the new federal budget. So all of our groups were going up to advocate to at least stay where we currently were so that we could continue the programs we're currently funding. What we were surprised to find, so we were gearing up to go talk with elected officials who have some skepticism about any kind of federal spending because they want to like balance the budget and they've got a bunch of other reasons why they would go that direction. So we were prepared, you know, when we go to talk to somebody like John Bozeman or Tom Cotton or Steve Womack, that they're going to be maybe aligned with the Trump administration's proposal. And what we were really surprised to learn is that there's actually widespread resistance to the Trump administration's proposal, even by the Republicans.
There's not a monolithic stand by one party
no.
or the other.
And we found out when we went up that even somebody like Mitch McConnell, who normally doesn't say anything publicly about this budgetary item, actually went out on a limb and spoke up in favor of maintaining the levels. Now, their reasons are maybe different. Like to them, it's a national security thing. If you spend more money on food, you have to spend less money on bullets because when places become insecure, our military ends up having to intervene or is more vulnerable.
So there are analytical reasons.
There's maybe different analytical reasons, and there might be different strategies or whatever. But what we found out was that not only do corporations favor global poverty relief and the faith-based community and lots of admirals and generals and military personnel, but even the people on both sides of the aisle do. So that made those conversations really kind of a great learning experience and really positive. The best one was actually with John Bozeman's staff. They were like bigger champions of foreign assistance than we are, and we were really kind of surprised to hear that. Although maybe we shouldn't have been. Maybe that was kind of a bias on our part going in. With the immigration one, that one was harder.
You went up before Senator Tom Cotton was next to President Trump with the RAISE legislation.
Well, and it's even more complicated than that. So that RAISE proposal, Cotton actually brought back in February of this year. It's just that Trump didn't announce his support of it until about a few weeks ago. And we went in March. So it was in the works. It wasn't. But what they do in the Senate is there's a whole bunch of things that people kind of throw up on the wall and then they see what sticks. So now the RAISE Act has stuck a little bit more, although whether it'll move forward is a whole other question, right? So when we go in to talk with somebody like Tom Cotton, there's not a lot of agreement between our faith-based community and him on, say, like refugee resettlement and immigration. Some really basic things, like we would like to see refugee admissions numbers go at least up to 75,000 next year, and we'd prefer for them to be at the levels they already were under the Obama designation in 2016. And his RAISE Act caps refugee admissions at 50,000. Those are really
big numbers.
Big differences in numbers. The Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service really supports DACA and supports humane immigration reform that gives people a path to citizenship. And Tom Cotton's RAISE Act is very much focused on only admitting skilled workers and
English speakers get
DACA
priority.
Right. So those are really, really big and different proposals. And so when we go in to talk with him about that, the way it kind of ends up happening mostly is he comes in and tells us what he's thinking and what he's planning to do. and we brought our stuff, and then he takes a picture with us. And then you kind of go out and you try to be as, you know, professional and whatever as possible, realizing that he's still driven mostly by, my perception is, an ideological perspective around immigration that's so at odds with what we're bringing that it's hard to know where the common ground might be. Except that with Cotton, for example, he did propose last year on humanitarian grounds that we should, in addition to the regular admission of refugees, we should admit 10,000 Christian Syrian refugees. So he actually had one proposal in there that would have increased refugee admissions to the U.S.
But based on religious preference.
On religious preference. So we could at least say to him then, well, you have found some reasons why increasing admissions of refugees to the United States is a good idea. Because of our religious faith and a commitment to welcoming the stranger and the refugee that we find throughout Scripture, we would like to extend that to all people, regardless of what their, you know, so then we would kind of come back trying to find where the common ground is. And then afterwards, you have to sort out, like, okay, is there a space in here where you could get him to shift, and how much more energy are we going to put into this given that maybe we can't even find any common ground?
Did these experiences, the better ones, the ones that might have been less fruitful, make you think in any way of how you talk to other people?
I've caught myself a few times communicating, say, in social media with some of our elected officials in ways that I then later regretted because it was driven kind of by my emotion. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to tweet out your emotions, especially when the President of the United States is modeling that constantly. So it's easy to kind of fall in line with that pattern. And that's, I've been finding that ultimately that's not productive because it makes the person you're trying to change even more resistant than they already were to what you're trying to bring. So I'm not sure what the answer is, especially when you're pushing up against somebody who really feels like a wall, right? Like, it's like, no matter what I say, no matter how many people say it, it still seems like that person that you're trying to change is just going to stick with what they're doing. That's very, that gets, that I can sympathize with why people get really frustrated.
And this spreads across ideological spectrum.
Yeah. Right. For me, it's out of my own, like, say, progressive faith values. But yeah, I'm sure that the same is true for people who are coming from another perspective, is they're equally frustrated when it seems like the person they're trying to have them hear isn't listening. But if you really actually want to be effective in having them hear you, I guess you do have to try to do some work to not unnecessarily put up guards so that they're just going to be so guarded from you that they're not going to listen. If Tom Cotton or Steve Womack or John Bozeman are actually listening to this broadcast, you know, what I'd want to say is, like, what I'm trying to do, it's sometimes hard, is let you know where I'm coming from as a pastor and as a Christian and hope that has some kind of impact on you while still, like, how can I disagree with you while still honoring your office and you as a person. You do wonder, there's all this movement around and all these people busily doing all these things and attending to all this, and you kind of like wonder to what degree you're just a small cog lost in a really big machine. And I think that actually it's both are true at the same time. You really are one little piece of a much larger machine, as is everybody. And also, going really makes a difference. So if you really care about something that you think that your congressman or congresswoman or senator could impact, it would be worth your time to schedule a meeting and make the trip. And then while you're there, go enjoy the mall and the lawn and do some other things in D.C. But they want to hear from you, and it often can make a difference.
Pastor Clint Schneckloth, thank you very much for your time.
Absolutely.
Not sure if you've heard, there will be an eclipse, a solar eclipse Monday that's going to be visible across the entire length of the United States. Last time the contiguous United States saw a total eclipse was in 1979. The path of totality, where the moon completely covers the sun, will stretch from Lincoln Beach, Oregon, to Charleston, South Carolina. Everyone else will get to see a partial solar eclipse. Northwest Arkansas is not in that path of totality, but it's pretty close, and there are plenty of events planned around the celestial event. Some of those events are going to be on the Buffalo National River. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with Buffalo Park guide Lauren Ray, who convinced her co-workers to make a music video to encourage others to come see the eclipse on the river. Take a listen.
About this video you guys made. I watched it and it definitely made me giggle a little bit.
We had a lot of fun with that. So we have been trying to figure out fun ways to engage the public and just get the word out about this major solar eclipse that's coming up later this month. And we were kind of brainstorming among our staff and we thought, I'll bet we could write a parody to Bonnie Tyler's song, Total Eclipse of the Heart, to go along with this event coming up. And so we wrote a parody called Solar Eclipse in the Park. And, yeah, we got this music video posted on our Buffalo National River Facebook page, and I think we're up to something like 54,000 views now, and a lot of people seem to enjoy it.
So who wrote the lyrics? Was it a sort of a group effort?
Yeah, it was. We have several really creative people on our staff that came together and wrote those lyrics, but it was mostly among our interpretation division, the people who do the education and outreach for the river.
So was it hard to convince people to be in the video, or was it pretty easy?
There were a few people that needed to be nudged a little bit, but I wanted to make sure that we had a pretty good representation of our staff who were included in the video. So we have a couple, actually, there were four people from the interpretation division. There was one person from our facility maintenance division. We had a couple of people from law enforcement and one person from fees. So, you know, we had a pretty good representation there of people who work in our parks upper and lower district. I had to kind of beg a couple folks. Everyone else was pretty excited about it.
Awesome. So who did the singing for the video?
That was me.
No, it's great.
Thank you.
So, you know, this eclipse, a lot of people talking about it. There's a lot of groups and organizations that'll be hosting events to watch it together. So why do you think the Buffalo's a good place to check it out?
Well, the Buffalo River is going to be a fantastic place to go to see the eclipse because we are in about 92% obstruction of the sun. You know, you hear about the path of totality up about 200 miles farther north from where we are. And most people who have been planning to see the total solar eclipse for a while booked their hotels up in the path of totality a long time ago. So if there are people trying to make arrangements last minute, they're probably going to find that hotels and lodging and accommodations in the path of totality are already booked. So the Buffalo is a really nice alternative because we're at about 92% obstruction of the sun. And what that means is right around 1:13 p.m. on Monday, August 21st, it's going to become sort of dusk-like up here. And we have a lot of areas along the river with a nice view of the sky. You've got wide open spaces at a lot of our campgrounds. There are several sweeping overlooks of the river where people can view the eclipse as well. And so this is going to be a really nice opportunity to be surrounded by the scenic beauty and the landscapes of Buffalo National River while also experiencing a once-in-a-lifetime celestial phenomenon.
How long will the eclipse last?
The whole length of the eclipse is going to be maybe an hour and a half long, but mm-hmm. the peak viewing time when the sun is obstructed about 92% will only be a 3 to 5 minute period of time. So uh-huh. I would say the best viewing time is going to be between 1:10 and 1:15 p.m.
So are you guys doing anything kind of special other than encouraging people to come to the Buffalo?
We are. Yeah. While we're obviously encouraging people just to visit the Buffalo River to experience the eclipse for themselves, we're also putting on some ranger programs in conjunction with the eclipse. So up here in the park's upper district, we will have a couple of rangers at Ozark Campground, which is located just a few miles north of the town of Jasper. And we're going to discuss some of the historical and ancient explanations for why eclipses occurred. You know, long before the modern era where we had technology that could tell us, oh, this is exactly what's happening in outer space right now. This is the explanation for it. Cultures around the world have had some really interesting folklore associated with eclipses. So we're going to go over that, starting at about 12:30 on the day of the eclipse. And then we will provide safety glasses to anybody who wants to stick around and actually see the eclipse happen. Also, down in the park's lower district at Buffalo Point, we'll have some ranger programs as well. And they're going to do programs leading up to the day of the eclipse to provide mm-hmm. some background information. So on Saturday evening, that would be August 19th, they're going to do an evening program on the history of eclipses, the effects on wildlife, and some of that historical information about explanations on the eclipses. That'll begin at 8:30 p.m. at Buffalo Point. Sunday, August 20th at 9 o'clock a.m., there will be a junior ranger activity for kids. It'll be an eclipse-themed craft. And then on Monday, the day of the eclipse, there will be a viewing party at the Buffalo Point restaurant down in the lower district.
So also, you guys will be providing the safety glasses, but everybody else who doesn't stop by your program definitely should bring their own pair.
Absolutely. One thing that we want to make sure that people understand is that regular sunglasses are not going to cut it in protecting your eyes. Because we're going to be looking directly at the sun to see this eclipse happen, you need to have a very specialized set of eclipse viewing glasses that have solar filters on them. And you can find those online pretty easily, and I've heard that a few stores around the area are also selling them. But you just want to ensure that the ones that you pick up are certified by NASA to be the correct type of solar filter.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with us and taking the time to tell us about the eclipse.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lauren Ray, a Buffalo National River Park guide, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek. You can watch the music video she and other staff made on the Buffalo National River Facebook page. And the American Astronomical Society has also put together a list of reputable eclipse glasses vendors on their website. You can just go to eclipse.aas.org.
91.3 is supported by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include American College of Radiology certified imaging departments, infusion centers, pharmacy, clinical trials, and more. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society and KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series continues with Six Strings, Six Stories, tracing the lineage of the jazz guitar with the Alex Wentz Trio. This performance is this Saturday night at 8 at the Haxton Road Studio in Bentonville. KUAF.com or digjazz.com for tickets.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Today is the first day of school in Farmington. A new school year often means new clothes, a new haircut, and new classes. This year, it also means a new building for high school students. Monday, parents and their children got their first look at the recently constructed building during an open house. Seniors Savannah Kilgore, Coleman Warren, and Maddie Bradley are all pleased with their new home for the year.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It's a big step up.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot bigger than I expected, too.
I really think that, like, it's going to actually make the kids want to learn. Like, one of the things is that, like, in an environment like this, they're going to want to take care of it. They're going to want to actually do stuff in it because they feel like, you know, this is state-of-the-art equipment. Like, in the new business rooms and the new ag rooms, you know what I mean? That kind of environment is what you want to build for kids to make them actually feel like they're learning something.
I think the senior class is going to take pride in being like the first class to be here.
To graduate from here.
Farmington High School principal John Pierfoy says he's extremely proud of the new building and excited for the community. About 575 students are enrolled in 10th through 12th grade. And Pierfoy says they needed a new school because of their growing population.
We've had so many teachers that have to share rooms now that just seems like every time one teacher gets out of a room, we had to put another teacher in that room to teach that class. So you didn't have any time to spend in your classroom on your conference period to be able to sit there and grade, catch up on the assignments that the kids produced and things like that. So you were always steadily just moving somewhere else and having to go sit in teacher's lounge and things like that, and that's kind of tough.
Clint Scrivener is beginning his 15th year of teaching at Farmington and says people are going to be blown away by the new facility.
The classrooms are all bigger, you know, everything's bigger. We got like new projectors and new technology, and it's very exciting. Farmington's always been a great place, though. It's just finally our building and everything matches up with, I think, you know, the people inside of it, and it's going to be awesome.
At the old high school, classes were spread out over a couple buildings. One of the perks of the new high school, Principal John Pierfoy says, is that it will allow students to take classes all under one roof.
We were basically spread out all over four areas. You know, we had to walk to the ag building. You had to walk to your East Labs, Art Lab, Spanish, and then you had to walk over to your science labs. And you had to walk outside in the rain, so we were spread completely out, and the safety of that area was not very good because anybody could walk in any of those doors. And now we have a beautiful building that you can lock down and no one can walk in the back doors unless somebody allows them to, opens the door for them.
Some of the old buildings will be torn down, while others will become places where students can take classes from Northwest Arkansas Community College and Northwest Technical Institute. Pierfoy says the new facility is nearly 100,000 square feet and offers lots of amenities.
We have a biomedical lab, which is up at the top. The kids will come in there and they'll do DNA testing and all kinds of stuff like that. We have our nursing area now where we have a mannequin, that's what they call it. It's not a dummy as they used to be, but it's a mannequin and you can inject him with shots. It gives you a heart rate. It could even die on you.
The school is also equipped with a pre-engineering lab and a business lab that has a ticker that wraps around the room. Pierfoy says the new high school means a lot because of where they started from.
That building over there has been redone several times, trying to make it a staple, a standpoint, the mothership, basically, of the community. And most of your high schools are. I'm not saying that just because it's ours, but it is the pride in the deal when you leave. And I think this is going to be a big pride factor for our community. We're very proud of this facility, and I know our kids are, and I know that they'll take great care of this facility. I'm not one bit least worried in that area, but we are very proud that we could do this for our community and put this together.
$30 million have been invested in the new high school campus. It's a project that began taking shape a few years ago with the construction of a performing arts center. With the completion of the high school, Pierrefoy says they'll begin working on a new football facility next. This is Ozarks at Large.
Walton Arts Center presents Taj Mo, the Taj Mahal and Keb Mo Band, September 19th at 7 p.m. Iconic blues legends Taj Mahal and Keb Mo will unite for a historic collaboration to extend and expand blues traditions. Tickets at 443-5600 or waltonartscenter.org. Support for 91.3 is provided by Brown's Tree Care, family-owned and operated in Northwest Arkansas with 52 years of experience in tree trimming, removal, stump grinding, and disease care. Fully insured with certified arborists, 273-0202 or brownstreecare.org. Additional support provided by Bombadil's Cafe, located on Highway 62 West in Eureka Springs. Bombadil's offering farm-to-table food using fresh ingredients, sustainable farming practices, and humanely raised local proteins. Open for lunch Wednesday and Thursday, lunch and dinner Friday and Saturday, and Sunday brunch. Hours and information at bombadillscafe.com.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Clarksville. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF.
We'll end the show with music from Youth Pastor. The band will be at Black Apple Crossing in Springdale Friday night beginning at 8. You can find out more about them at their Facebook page. We're going to hear the song, My Place. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks so much for listening.
Back to my